high anxiety whenever you're near. High anxiety, it's you that I fear. My heart's afraid to fly, it's crashed before. But then you take my hand, my heart starts to soar once more.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Courtney Hameister, Portland-based author of the new book, Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things, in conversation with Gigi Little, editor of City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales. In Okay, Fine, Whatever, Courtney chronicles the year she spent fighting back against her debilitating anxieties by doing things that scared her. Such things as booking a session with a professional cuddler, spending an afternoon in a sensory deprivation tank, getting high on pot in the middle of a workday, taking classes in fellatio and water aerobics, and those were two separate classes, by the way, partaking of a sex club and its build-your-own burrito bar, and going on a series of first dates, lots and lots of first dates. Courtney was the host, head writer, and co-producer for Livewire, a nationally syndicated public radio variety show based in Portland, and her work has appeared in McSweeney's, Portland Monthly, Oregon Humanities Magazine, the web series The Benefits of Husbandry, and APM's Marketplace. In addition to editing City of Weird, Gigi has published essays and short fiction in anthologies and literary magazines, including Portland Noir, Spent, and the Pacific Northwest Reader. She works as a marketing coordinator at Powell's Books and also as the graphic designer for Portland publisher Forest Avenue Press. Let's join Courtney and Gigi as they talk about Courtney's new book, Writing, Radio, Humor, Bravery, Romance, and Anxiety.
You said in your book that you thought being the host of Livewire Radio was maybe the best job in Portland.
I think so, yeah.
And so I realized that right now I have the best job in Portland because I get to talk to you and hear you talk about how you do very cool creative things.
Yes.
And it's also, you're right. I'm very anxious right now.
Yes.
And it made me wonder, why is it that all the best things, the quote unquote best things, cause us anxiety?
Well, I spent some time teaching kids through writers in the schools, through literary arts.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I had the great honor of going into Portland and Gresham High Schools and teaching high school seniors and juniors. And one of the things that I tried to tell them was, if you're not anxious, you're not doing anything interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason that we get anxiety is because we are emotionally invested. It means something to us, right? And so in some ways, like I had this friend, my friend Mark Aceto, who's a writer, and he said he actually loves jealousy because and envy because it points him toward what he wants in his life, right?
Yeah.
And I think that anxiety in some ways, we could look at anxiety as doing us somewhat of a favor, right? Because suddenly if you see it show up on you, you can say, oh, I really care about this. This is something that means something to me, right? It's like that, you know, people talk about jitters when they fall when they're falling in love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's because you really care about what this
oh,
you
yeah.
get nervous when you're around them because they matter to you and you think that there's possibility and potential in that. And so and I think that in the book I also say that in some ways we're kind of lucky, people who have anxiety, because when you're afraid of everything, everything is kind of an adventure. Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think that in some ways, yeah, you're not lucky if you're a person who have anxiety. It's difficult. But I think that's why the things that really mean something to us make us anxious. And I think that, you know, in some ways it is. It's a little bit of a favor to us because we can have some sort of self-awareness around
wow.
that.
Yeah, because all of the things that I look back on and I say, wow, that was such a cool thing. When I did it, I was kind of freaking out, you know? And I kind of wish that I wasn't freaking out when I did it, but maybe that's why I remember it so much.
That's, you know, I was very, very lucky to know Tisha Helgerson, who was the lead singer of a band called Amelia, and she had this stunning voice. It was a Portland band. She passed away in 2011, but we met, I was the host of Livewire, and I remember meeting her. She was this stunning woman. It wasn't just that she had this beautiful voice. She was just physically so beautiful. Mm. And it turned out when I met her, so funny and so smart and just amazing. And I just wanted to be her, essentially. Mm. And one of the very funny things that sort of evolved from our relationship with one another is that whenever I would have a Livewire show and whenever she would have an Amelia show, we would like text each other and be like, who thought this was a good idea? This is awful. This is the worst thing in the world. Why am I doing this? And I just remember, like, she had such a beautiful voice, and the audience loved hearing her so much, and it was so inspiring to them. And it was so depressing to me that she couldn't feel the joy that they felt while she was performing, right? Like, it took a ton for them to kind of, for their adulation or joy to kind of push through her anxiety so that she would actually enjoy it. And I think that's a real tragedy. Yeah. And it's a tragedy of so many performers who have anxiety. You know, I think it was Pablo Casals, I read, had massive anxiety. And there are lots of performers who can't get away from it. But they also, like Elliot Smith, I mentioned in my book, you feel so strongly about the work and the work getting out that you push through it.
Yeah, you get obsessed by the work, and somehow that overpowers everything else. And I think that a lot of performers are really anxious people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, neuroticism is, I think, you know, I spoke to William Todd Schultz, who wrote the Elliot Smith biography, and he talked about, like, a lot of performers are high in neuroticism. Yeah. They're also low in extroversion. That was my issue. I was high in neuroticism, low in extroversion.
Yeah, yeah.
That's ridiculous that I was a performer and had that combination. But at the same time, like, I just had my book release show, and there is nothing like that feeling. I went out there and I just sort of told a story from the book. You know, I didn't actually read.
Oh, really?
And there's nothing like that feeling of going out there and telling a story. My story happens to be about peeing my pants
on a date. Oh my gosh,
right?
That's a fabulous story.
But you tell a story like that, and when you hear people laughing, it is them recognizing themselves in you. And if you think that you're a freak, there is nothing like that experience of saying, I'm not a freak. There are hundreds of people out there, and they see themselves in my experience. So I can't be a freak.
Yeah. Or we're all freaks. And
exactly.
You know, that's just fine.
Exactly. If we're all freaks, then none of us are freaks. Yeah. That's my mantra, really. I have a few of them. Also, feelings are not facts is also one of my new mantras.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
I got that on a pillow from a therapist friend the other night. It was glitter. All the letters were glitter. It was very festive.
Anything that's drawn in glitter, you should believe.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I'd like to talk about Livewire.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious about what it was like to write for Livewire and then host for Livewire.
Mm-hmm. Well, our writing process, I was lucky enough to be a part of The State, which was this very, very funny group of comedy writers who had a show on MTV way back in the 90s. And I had met them when I was at NYU. And they were some of the most prolific, talented comedic writers and actors that I've ever come across in my life. Mm. And I was behind the scenes with them. I did things like I art directed their films, and I produced and sort of technical directed their live shows. But I got to sit in on their rehearsals and their writers' meetings. Mm. And so I, for 2 years, got to see how they worked. And so that's actually what made me approach Kate Sokoloff and Robin Tenenbaum and say,
about
hey,
Livewire.
Exactly. Oh. Maybe I can be the head writer of this show. Ooh. Even though I'd actually written two jokes, they'd like taken two of my joke suggestions while I was with The State. So it was kind of based on my experience of watching how they worked. Mm. We had anywhere from, like, I think at one point we may have had 6 writers, but in general it was around 4 or 5. And it was wonderful because we would bring in a guest writer from the community. So it might be like Daniel Wilson, who wrote Robopocalypse, mm-hmm, Chelsea Kane. We would have people, we would have a theme to the shows. And so the writers would know what the themes were. They would come in with 15 sketch ideas. And I would look at those ideas and I would tell them to write 5 of them. And that was because we knew that we'd probably want 2 from each writer. But what tends to happen is you'll have this great idea and you'll think it's an amazing sketch, when in actuality, it's just a funny little anecdote.
One little thing, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you might get one line from it. Yeah. And so I would say, I think these have potential. And then, you know, some of them might not go anywhere. And then they would, of course, write what meant the most to them, what they felt was the strongest, and also what sort of you can sense in the room what's going to hit the most.
Oh.
And so they would come back and they would have the first drafts. And I think that for me, it was extremely important to have a collaborative writer's room. And this was based on really my experience with the state. And then also my own experience recognizing that my work was always made better by input from other people.
Yeah, yeah.
And that didn't always work for people. There were people who were in our writer's room who we called it preciousitis. And what that meant was that they believed that they printed out that version of the sketch and that it was their perfect little baby.
And that was it, yeah.
And have you ever told anyone that their baby is unattractive?
Yeah.
It
I have not, so I don't know how I would do that. I couldn't have that job that you just that
well,
you did.
It doesn't go over well. You can imagine,
no.
Right? And so what I really tried to do was tell people, please bring it in rough. You know,
yeah.
There were people
who
would just work and work and work something and bring it in. Well, when you do that, you don't want to let go of anything, mm-hmm, because you worked on it really hard. And that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But it's like, it turns out it's actually, you know, this is the best part of the sketch. And so this is the part that you should really work on. And and they don't want to. I already worked on it a lot and it's perfect.
Yeah. Right.
So we tried to keep people from having preciousitis. We also learned from people. You know, we had a lot of people who didn't want to say anything bad about other people's work because they didn't want to make them look bad.
Mm-hmm.
When in actuality, if I tell you all of these things about your work that are going to make it better, I'm telling you, your work is good enough for me to actually spend my time on
it. Right. Yeah.
And you need to recognize that. And then also, being a good writer is being able to differentiate between what's going to make your work better and what's going to make your work someone else's work.
Uh-huh.
That's the real, I think, work of being a writer.
That's when you graduate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you can make that differentiation, mm-hmm, as a writer, then you're actually, you know, and your work's going to be significantly better. But it's so hard, right? Because it's so personal.
It's so personal.
They're not spreadsheets.
No.
It means, like you were saying earlier, it means something to us. And that's why we have anxiety about it. And that's why we have preciousitis.
Yeah.
This is something that I care about. And it's coming from, you know, a real personal, deep place in me.
Mm-hmm.
Even though sometimes the sketches were, you know, ridiculous and dumb, you know, about Smunky. I remember my favorite Sean McGrath was an ad for Uncle Pappy's peanut butter. It's smooth and chunky. It's Smunky. See, sometimes it's just that, and so you really don't need to, like, hold on to it with both fists.
Keep that. You can use it someplace.
Exactly. That's not art. I don't know what it is.
It's Smunky.
Exactly. I don't know, but it's Smunky. Yes.
Well, once you went on to being the host,
mm-hmm,
how did that change your relationship with, I guess, the anxiety? Because I don't know, for me, it seems like the... telling people what to do, not what to do, but what to expand on, and you know, and being sort of in a managerial role, that seems, mm-hmm, really scary, you know.
Yes.
And then you were in a kind of, you were still writing when, mm-hmm, you were hosting, right?
Yes.
So you had two things that...
Three. I was producing as well.
And producing.
Yeah. That's that's what's known as dumb. That's just dumb for someone who had my sensibilities. It's so funny. I remember when I very first started on the show, there are these photographs of me sort of throwing stuff up on a wall, and we had these little colored cards for all the sketches. And I remember what I felt like, and it was fun. Right. It was I was having fun because I wasn't hosting the show. Uh-huh. I was just doing the comedy.
And it was
that great sort of, you know, you have that adrenaline, but it's that positive adrenaline that's just doing you a favor. Right. Instead of the adrenaline that's actually making you feel like garbage and terrified. So, yeah, I think that it's funny. I write about it in the book. My so many things that I sort of regretted and. Mm. One was this that I think that the I was a producer on the show, and one of the main jobs of a producer is to be what they call in the improv world fit in well, and that is that no matter what happens, if there is a light that drops from the ceiling and hits your co-host on the head. That you look at the audience and you act like it was a joke while you're dialing 911, right? That's a producer's job that everyone on the staff knows. No matter what happens, everything's okay. And I know that because of my anxiety, I never looked like everything was okay. You know, like
it was on your face.
I know it was all over my body and my face. One of our writers one time was just like, you know, we were having an argument about something and he was like, it's awful. You know, you're just, you know, you're a mess. And it's, you know, and I apologize, you know, I said, yeah, you know what I am. So I think that I regret that. I also regret that. I think that I had, I did have this imposter syndrome forever on this job. And so in the beginning, unfortunately, I had a couple of people who just didn't have a lot of faith in my ability. And that really came through kind of in our interactions with one another. And unfortunately, that just carried through with people who did have faith in my ability. And so I became very strident. I became very much like my word is the you know, I'm the boss of it. I get the final word. When in actuality, I wanted a collaborative room.
Right.
But there was this voice in my head that was saying, if you don't see me as the final word on this, you're not respecting me as the head writer. And that was absolutely not true. Like, they totally respected me. But I still had those early voices in my head who I knew didn't believe in me. Yeah. And that's how our brains work, right? Yeah. It's an ancient thing that our brain sort of remembering bad things and replaying those in our heads. The reason that at least I've read this, the reason that happens is, let's say that you're, you know, in prehistoric times and there's a saber-toothed tiger and you watch it eat a friend of yours.
Right.
Your brain goes, saber-toothed tiger will kill you. I'm going to replay that a few more times in your head so you'll remember, so it's not going to happen to you.
Yeah.
That's my understanding of why our brains do that so much more.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's terrible is that the bad stuff, right? The one bad review that I got on the internet for this show that we did that was amazing and did very, very well and got great reviews. But the one comment that was horrible, I remember word for word.
That's what you remember, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrible the way our brains work.
I wonder if part of the reason that we go so big on the bad stuff is that we don't have to worry about dying all the time.
Yes. Yeah. I was just talking about that the other night at my at the book release show, just about how is our anxiety privilege,
right?
Is it based in privilege?
Oh,
right? Because I can be anxious because I'm not actually being chased by a bear, or there aren't bombs going off in my backyard. If there were bombs going off in my backyard, I wonder if my central nervous system would actually click in and be completely effective at that point, or would my pathology still be there and I would turn out being ineffective in a situation like that? I don't know what the answer to that question is, because I haven't been bombed yet. But I think it's a very interesting question. You know?
Yeah.
But it's a great question. Let's research that and then we'll get back to people
with
the answer. Or maybe if listeners have the answer, they can put them in the comments along with horrible things that they're going to say about the size of my butt.
okay.
Because they're going to be intermixed in there. It's just going to happen because it's the internet. I'm very proud of myself for saying but, by the way. I haven't said that word in 20 years.
Really?
Well, I mean, if...
On there. I want to...
Yeah.
But.
It's really... It's
that was exciting.
Isn't it? It's just... it's invigorating. just walking to the edge of that line.
Yes. And invigorating and anxiety-inducing. Same kind of feeling.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Same neighborhood.
Just, like, get used to pretending it's the good one.
Right.
You know? So, right. What was the most anxiety-inducing time you had on Livewire?
Oh gosh. I mean, it was every week. Every week I had anxiety. Yeah. I talk about it in the book. There were a couple times. One was when M. Ward was on, who I love his work and his music. He's an amazing musician. I thought that he was just being very quiet. He wasn't really answering my questions. And I just thought, oh my gosh, he's so shy. He's such a shy guy. And then he did this thing. The whole time that I was talking to him, he was just kind of fiddling with his guitar. And at one point, this was at the Aladdin Theater, a full Aladdin Theater. So 600 and something people. And at one point, he just turns around to face me. And he gives me this kind of sly grin. And I thought, is this guy screwing with me right now in front of all of these people? And I was like, this is a terrible time to screw with me, M. Ward. Like, please don't do this. So I don't actually know what the truth is about whether he was actually shy or an introvert or what the situation was. But that was very anxiety inducing because for some reason, whenever I was interviewing musicians, I believe that there's this little bit of magic in music. Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't understand it that well. Mm-hmm. And so I always felt a little bit at a disadvantage with music. But then the worst time was when we brought on a vintner, and he had this great champagne. And, so we brought him on around the holidays because we wanted to talk to people about champagne and, you know, the different kinds and just talk to us about why do we celebrate with champagne? Questions like that. Yeah. And you do a pre-interview and you kind of talk to people about what you're going to talk about. So I did that with him, and he came on the show, and for whatever reason, he did not want to talk about champagne. And he talked about everything else. He talked about love and science and physics and all this stuff, to the point where it turned into a thing where the audience, I was sort of flabbergasted and the audience was flabbergasted with me. And every time I would ask a question he wouldn't answer it, the audience would burst into laughter. You know, it's like, oh my God, he's doing it again. He's not answering again. And then he sabered a bottle. Have you ever seen someone saber a bottle?
Right. Yeah,
it's where they take a knife and they throw it up a bottle of champagne, and somehow by pushing it up the bottle, they can knock off the entire top of the bottle, including the glass and the cork. And he did that, and it actually hit someone. And I just sat there thinking, I wish that was me, and they were taking me to the hospital right now, and I wouldn't have to finish this interview because it's miserable. I just was so miserable. But that's the thing. That's the question that I asked myself, right, about the anxiety. Mm-hmm. If I didn't have this anxiety, would I be enjoying this?
Right. Would I be
laughing? Because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Would I? Exactly. I don't know the answer to that question. I feel like there are certain people who would have been loving it.
Yeah.
And I would love to be one of those people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know?
Me too.
Yeah.
Oh, I get that.
Yeah.
And later it becomes something that you can talk about and laugh about. And mm-hmm. it becomes material and it becomes a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
But in the moment, unfortunately, it's mm-hmm. not, you know?
Yeah. As soon as you have a little distance and perspective.
Yeah.
But that's what it's like. It's, you know, it's like that's what I tell people about who have anxiety about taking something like there were times when I took Xanax wasn't great for me. But I would take Ativan, which is a benzodiazepine and not great for your brain. I don't recommend it at all if you can avoid it. But I called it perspective in a pill because it allowed you to actually, you took it and it calmed your brain down and you were able to just sort of look and actually see what was in front of you for what it was, which is the same thing mindfulness does, right?
Oh,
like
right,
if you can really teach yourself mindfulness, that's the same thing. If you can do it without actually taking a benzo, that's what I recommend to people, you know? If you can do that, that would be great.
Yeah, mindfulness is great. I took a class
yes.
on it a while ago, and it just, I mean, you have to keep up with it as much.
Yeah.
That's what I didn't do, but.
Yeah, but it's like, that's what I talk to, you know, when I'm teaching kids too, I talk about that where it's like, you know, mindfulness is about dealing with what is in front of me right now.
Yeah.
And can I handle it? Yeah. And if I have to perform for 400 people tomorrow, mm-hmm. that's scary. But I have to make this PowerPoint presentation right now. What's in front of me right now? One frame, one sentence in one frame. Mm-hmm. How much anxiety does that give me? None.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can just see that and just keep seeing what's in front of me, it's extraordinarily powerful.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hugely helpful if you can actually connect to it.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can get past all of the chemicals, like cortisol, right, that are going through your system, if you can get past those and actually see what's in front of you, then it's really powerful.
Yeah. It's amazing that you can do something completely unchemical, you know, meditation, mm-hmm. and actually supersede those chemicals in some way.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, it's practice, I think.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I've been talking for a long time. We haven't even gotten to the book.
Right.
We haven't gotten to
there's
any
stuff
of the amazing
I've talked about a lot
done.
Of stuff that's in the book.
But I wanted to talk about a few of the experiences you had.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I would talk. I thought I'd start with the cuddler.
Sure. Why not talk about the cuddler?
I wanted to hear about that because I will say for me, I just don't like to be touched, I guess, you know? Do you like getting massage?
I do. I'm fine with that. Yeah.
I can't stand it. I can't imagine being,
are you okay with someone that you care about touching you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I know you. And, you know, I mean, they're going to put their hand on my shoulder or whatever that's, but, you know, don't rub my back. I don't know. There's something.
I totally get that.
Give me a manicure. I don't want to. So, and, you know, to do that with a person, you know, to have a person who, you know, to touch you in kind of an intimate way and they don't love you.
Mm-hmm.
It's just weird. And so that seemed like one of the things, because as I read your book, there would be those, I'd be weighing myself against your book. I'm like, I'd probably do that. I might be able to do that. There's no way I'd do that. I could not do the cuddler, I don't think.
Sure. There's a ton of people who couldn't do the cuddler.
Yeah.
But this is the thing. They say they couldn't do the cuddler, but when my editor sent me the email said, do you want to do this? Do you think you can do this? I immediately said no.
Uh-huh.
But then I thought, oh, I think that I can't do this, so I should do it.
I should do it, yeah.
And I am a person, one of the reasons that I was interested in it was that it turns out that I'm a person who really loves physical affection, mm-hmm. and in fact was a little concerned that I needed it too much,
mm-hmm.
because I hadn't had it for so long.
Yeah.
I was in this relationship with a polyamorous married guy who had been, you know, very honest, and his wife was the person who said, let's be polyamorous. And what was amazing about him was he actually was the king of the afterglow. Like, so you would, I was in what was definitely sort of a casual relationship with him, but he would do this thing where he would sort of run his hand up and down my forearm while we were just sort of chatting in the afterglow, right? And it felt so real and so intimate, mm-hmm. and so like he'd been doing it for years. And that was exactly what I wanted, was that feeling, you know? And I loved it so much. And so that was part of the reason that I was curious about going to the cuddler, and knowing that he had created this simulacrum of intimacy, right? Mm-hmm. This exact feeling that I wanted, but without any of the emotional intimacy. We didn't have anything in common. So I was like, how is he doing this?
Yeah.
And I think that what I discovered when I met Samantha Hess, who is she owns Cuddle Up to Me, which is the cuddling business. My experience of meeting her, and everyone's is different, but I think that there are some people who are more generous than others, say financially. And what I saw in her and in this guy that I dated was that there are also some people who are physically and emotionally more generous, where they're willing to give you the benefit of the doubt that you're lovable without you actually proving it to them.
Wow.
And they just give you that affection and that love and that caring without you having to show them that you're worthy of that. And I And that
and
was
it's a real thing.
Feels real. And it could be that Samantha and this guy are just super good at pretending.
Right.
But that's what it felt like to me. And I think that and so I went into that experience with Samantha, the cuddler. I met her and she immediately sort of put me at ease based on who she is and how she's just very bubbly and friendly and is just able to put anyone at ease. And then I was massively anxious and felt incredibly awkward in the initial sort of positions that we were in. And she has 56 different cuddling positions, which is amazing to me. But in the initial positions, I was also really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I have to say that in the end, once you sort of settle into it, someone running their fingers through your hair is someone running their fingers through your hair. You know, it's just, it's the same thing with a massage.
Yeah.
It feels good kind of when anyone's doing it.
Yeah.
And so, but what I did say about that experience is that it feels to me very poignant. Hmm. If you're a person who doesn't get touched a lot, it feels to me like it's this thing that you've always wanted, while at the same time a reminder that you don't have it.
Right.
And so it just feels difficult. You know, and that's, I think, what my experience was, is when she was doing that, I was like, this is what I want, and I don't have it right now. And so so that was a great, like we were talking about anxiety pointing to us to what means something to us, you know?
Yeah.
It was a great sort of directional, you know, oh, okay. So this, I was having a lot of sexual experiences during that period, and it really helped me to be like, that's really not what I want.
Yes.
I want somebody to hold my hand.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I really wanted. So it was helpful in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a beautiful essay.
Oh, thanks.
I think I told you before I bawled on the bus reading totally. I mean,
I started out
like giggling in the bus and then I was bawling on the bus. So yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. That was, because I was crying, you know,
she'd made me
say affirmations, which, ugh.
Yeah.
It was really rough.
Yeah.
I just generally hate them, but she got me with them.
Right. Yeah. And it wasn't what you wanted to hear at the time, but it really was an important thing. I mean, it was one of those really huge moments in the book and obviously in your life. So
yeah.
Yeah, that was really beautiful.
Thank you.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, our guest is Courtney Hameister, Portland-based author of the new book, Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things, in conversation with Gigi Little, editor of City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales.
So let's talk about weed.
Sure. Let's do that. It's Oregon.
I thought it was really interesting that you had one of your essays in the book and one of your experiences that you did in the project was smoking weed at work.
Yes.
And my first thought was, you know, in what way is this anxiety inducing? However, I think that weed does the same thing to me that as it does to you. I think that my body does not do well with it. And the few times that I remember, you know, and I never probably did it till I was like 30 years old or something, you know, kind of thing. And I'm like fiercely anxious about smoking, like that just grosses me out. So I've only ever done like edibles, and so those can be dangerous, right? So somebody gave us some candies, and you know, and we were like, my husband and I were watching some you know show. Sandra Bernhardt. Yeah, we're watching some comedy show, and we were just sitting, you know, back watching, and all of a sudden I was like, and I said to my husband, call 911. And he said, really? I said, no. But I didn't know what to do. You know, it's like, I'm going to be this way for the rest of my life, you know, kind of thing. But
the way that you said that, so call 911.
Like, it was very... so,
no one's ever said call 911 that calmly.
In a very calm way. Because I couldn't move at that point. I was like, I'm just stuck. I don't want to move my cheeks right now.
You know? Oh my God.
So I really identified with your essay, and so I thought we'd talk about
your
experience.
Yeah.
Too.
Well, I think that so what I so the reason that you You've told me that you're an anxious person.
Yeah.
And and here's the thing about weed. I love that weed is legal. I think that if alcohol is legal, then weed should be legal. It's ridiculous. But I will say this. My concern is that there's not a warning on weed. And the warning should be, well, I mean, here's the problem, is that weed does many of the same things to your body that an anxiety attack does to your body.
Yes.
You get tingling in your extremities. You get a rush of adrenaline often. Mm-hmm. You dissociate. All of these things, if they happen to you and you are a person who is prone to panic attacks, you're going to have a freaking panic attack.
Right.
Because part of having an anxiety or a panic attack is that you'll have these symptoms. It happens to people sometimes who run, right? Because then your adrenaline is up. Mm-hmm. Your heart rate goes up.
Yeah.
And the problem with weed and is that it will cause that to happen. And sometimes the only reason that you have a panic attack is because you think you're going to have a panic attack.
Right. Yeah.
And it tells your brain, oh, no. And your brain gets freaked out. Mm-hmm. It then increases those symptoms and it turns into this horrible, unhealthy loop.
The human body is a jerk, right?
Oh, my. The brain is a total jerk.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times has your brain really screwed you?
Oh, always.
And so,
always.
You know, like, you know, it's just like, can you just calm down this one time? Or, you know, like there's so many ways. But that's my issue with weed, is that I really wish that there were some sort of warning on it that says, if you are a person who has anxiety or is prone to panic attacks, please consult your physician before trying marijuana.
Yeah.
Because the great, what I will tell people also is, if you have panic attacks, that beta blockers for me as a performer were magical. Beta blockers lower your heart rate. Well, I don't know if they lower your heart rate, but they lower your blood pressure.
Yeah.
And so what they do is they stop that loop, right? Where, oh no, I'm having a panic attack. It goes to your brain. Your brain's like, oh no, a panic attack's happening. But your body, because your symptoms are all quiet, your body goes, no, I'm not. So it just stops the loop, you know?
Yes.
So we, in the book, we decided to smoke weed at work with, you know, permission from our boss and try to write comedy sketches on weed, which is, no one has ever in the history of time done that. We were completely original. And then, of course, I ended up having, you know, massive anxiety that I had to hide from all my coworkers.
Yeah,
so
terrible.
It was I'm going to say not recommended. I'm not going to recommend that experience.
I want to say, I want to just like, you know, kind of change the subject slightly from the weed back to the beta blockers, because I took them before I came here.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And part of that goes back to the first time I met you. So I knew who you were, right? I knew about LiveWire, and I thought, and I was like enamored of you and stuff. We met at the, periodic, maybe monthly arts event called Share.
Yes,
right,
amazing.
Margaret Malone, Kathleen Lane, they run this thing, and
it's one of my favorite things in the world.
Yeah, and artists of all sorts come together. They get a prompt. They create for a while, and then they share it. Which, oh my God, you know, there you go, anxiety, right?
Yep.
And so I was doing it as a writer, and you were there writing, and you started talking about having anxiety, and we were talking about beta blockers because I had just had my first short story published, and I was going to do an event, and I was going to have to read it in public, and I'd never done that before.
Yeah.
And Kathleen said, well, you know, you should take a beta blocker, and I'd never heard of them. And you said, oh, I take them. And I was like floored, because I thought, if you have anxiety, you know, and if you deal with anxiety, I can be okay with anxiety. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was huge for me, actually. And it helped me, like, become, like, kind of go forward as a writer and as a person who was doing readings. I did a lot more readings. And it wasn't just beta blockers. It was also knowing that people are out there who seem so with it, so strong and so not anxious. And they're dealing with it, too, you know?
Well, I think that what people who have anxiety forget is how well they hide their own anxiety. And so they think that other people don't have it, and they don't realize they're just hiding it as well as I do.
Right?
Because people, you become very good at that. And I think the number of people that I worked at LiveWire for 12 years. I hosted for around a decade. the number of performers that I met, you know, I talked to one musician and I was amazed because he was so just he appeared so calm and so easygoing and so comfortable on stage. And he told me that he had anxiety. Right. And I said, that's amazing. I would have never guessed that you had anxiety. And he said, oh yeah, it's why I'm an alcoholic. Very like casually. Oh yeah. You know, that's why. And it was amazing to me. And it's the number of people that I met who said that they had some kind of, you know, issue. I think that it's the same as so many aspects of our lives where we walk around thinking everyone else has their shit together. And everyone, as my friend Marie says, everyone doesn't have their poop in a group. like nobody does. Everyone is, you know, I heard an interview with Judd Apatow on Marc Maron's show. Mm. And he said, I never feel like I own the moment. I always feel like the giant nerd. Even on my own film sets, I never feel like I have it together. Yeah. And it's like, well, if he doesn't, who does? Yeah. You know, like, and you hear this all the time from people who are at the top of their game. And so I just wish that we could all remember this as we're walking around and trying new things.
Yeah.
And just remember that everyone is scared. Yeah. And no one thinks they know it all. Yeah. They can act like they do, but the people in my experience who claim to know it all are the ones who are the most scared.
Yeah.
You know, like those people who have the most bravado are using that bravado to cover for something.
Right.
And so I just feel like it's sad to me that we just in many ways, how as a culture we hide our vulnerabilities. And, you know, Brene Brown, you know, has been doing this vulnerability work for so many years. And I think it's gendered, the fact that our culture doesn't respect vulnerability because vulnerability is more feminine generally.
Yeah.
And it is to me, you know, I remember I did a graduation speech a few years ago. And one of the things I sort of gave this list, right, of all of these things, very quick pieces of advice. And one of the things that I said was, if you're in a relationship just one time in your life, be the one who loves more. Because and it will make you feel like you're the weak one and you're the vulnerable one, but you're the brave one.
Wow.
Right? Like you're the one who's willing to take the chance to say, I love more. I know that I love you more than you love me, but I'm in it. I'm willing to take that chance. That's the bigger chance, right? Yeah. Than being this like stoic person who's not willing to offer yourself up to someone. Yeah.
That's
amazing. Yeah. Yeah. So I would hope that we're as a culture, because mental illnesses and pathologies I think are being more accepted, I would hope that as a culture we're more willing to admit to people that we have these fears, and that way we're not all pretending all
it
the time.
It normalizes it.
Yeah.
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 You know, you mentioned gender, and I had been wanting to talk about that kind of. One thing I was thinking about when I was reading your book, and it feels weird to talk about, I actually read an essay about this on KBOO's Bread and Roses once, about and somehow it's easier for me to write an essay and read it and then just sort of come out and say, I spend a lot of time questioning whether it is really true that I'm lesser because I'm a woman, right?
Yeah.
And I think I'm a little obsessed with them. I think it all the time, like in all situations. I'm
really
thinking this thing. I'm always like, you know, yeah, like, you know, I'm getting ready to come today. I'm like, I'm feeling nervous. I shouldn't be nervous. Am I being a woman? And the thing is, it's like weakness you were talking about before. Weakness is, you know, it's associated with anxiety. It's associated with being a woman, you know?
Neuroticism.
Neuroticism.
Yeah, hysteria.
Yes, yes, yes. Right. You know, emotion in general, or whatever. And I, you know, so I was wondering about that when I was reading your book, because, you know, you are a strong woman, a hilarious woman, and an anxious woman, you know? And so how do those things come together around being a woman?
Yeah. It's so funny that you say that. It really surprises me that you kind of have this question all the time about being a woman and whether it's so funny, because in general, that idea of, am I lesser because I'm a woman? In general, I would, it's so ridiculous. Of course
not, right?
But I do think that I sometimes see my neuroticism as feminine and weak, you know? I mean, it's something that, of course, I hate that idea that I do, but there's tons of stuff, you know, that I recognize in the book that makes me a bad feminist, right? My body issues.
Right.
I felt it was important for me to make clear, oh, well, this is kind of how I felt at the time, and I don't really feel this way anymore when, you know, and that's actually really not true. I still struggle with body issues. There is an aspect of my anxiety that does feel a little bit gendered, but I think that it's less that I think that anxiety is female, mm-hmm. and more that I think that we are as women more able to express our anxiety because men are so socialized to shove everything mm-hmm. down that has anything to do with vulnerability or weakness mm-hmm. or neuroticism or any of that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I think that it's just that I'm able to more show it mm-hmm. because I'm a woman. And I guess I should be grateful for that. I mean, I gotta tell you, if I felt all the things that I feel and wasn't allowed to tell the people in my life that I was going through it, I don't know if I would survive.
Yeah, right.
As women, I'm so grateful to be a woman and to be able to go to my friends and tell them what I'm struggling with and have them empathize with me and have them hear me and without trying to fix it and just be with me in that. Like, I think that I'm pretty grateful for.
Yeah, me too. Totally. And, you know, I don't think, you know, it's not as extreme as it used to be. Men, you know, are much more open. They're much more able to feel, you know, comfortable with feelings than it used to be. But as much as we move into, you know, this modern time, the men still, I think, have that baggage that even, you know, it's still there. It, just like my baggage is still there, that I'm always questioning whether I'm secondary, you know? Yep. It's always there, you know?
Well, I don't think that our culture has done men favors by telling them that they can't cry or they can't feel vulnerable or they can't show vulnerabilities. Like, that's terrible.
Yeah.
That's a, you know, I think that my experience, I think also with the men in my life, there's men, I think, who have sort of eschewed a lot of that older stuff. And like, my brother has such amazing, intimate relationships with his male friends. Mm. You know, they are completely honest with one another. They can be vulnerable. They can, you know, it's very similar to my experiences with my female friends. But I also have men who are of this same generation that I know who, you know, they might go fishing with male friends and maybe, like, admit that they, you know, might have a little bit of vulnerability, but, you know, mostly they'll just, like, you know, talk about fishing and maybe have some subtext about, I might leave my wife next month because I'm desperately lonely. Right. But it's like this tiny, you know, subtext in one sentence about bait, you know, like, and that's just not a fun way to live.
That's a sad thing. Yeah.
It is.
Maybe it's, you know, kind of circles back to that thing about anxiety being a, you know, an indicator of, you know, you just having feelings about something and how it shouldn't be, you know. We also shouldn't, just like men shouldn't have to feel like they can't, you know, cry or feel something or share something, we shouldn't feel like we can't be afraid, you know.
Well, you can't, I mean, I think that one of the things that William Todd Schultz talks about in his book about Elliot Smith that I thought was amazing was that one of the ways that Elliot Smith made his anxiety go away was that he admitted it to the audience. Because mm-hmm. I think that we as anxious people, we have this anxiety, but on top of the anxiety, we're anxious about people seeing it and recognizing it. They'll see that we're having trouble breathing mm-hmm. deeply, or they'll see mm-hmm. that something's caught in our throat. They'll hear that something's caught in our throat. Mm-hmm. And that is a great way to get rid of that fear and anxiety that adds on to what is already there, is to just be honest about it and say, you know, go into a meeting and say, you guys, I just have to let you know, I'm kind of anxious about this right now.
Yes.
And that's relatable. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Right. You know what? I'm not going to say it works in every situation. Steve Jobs probably, I don't know, wasn't a great idea for him to walk out every year, you know, at whatever that Apple summit was. And and be honest. But there are, in many situations, if we can actually get rid of that secondary anxiety, which is the fear that people are going to know, by just letting them know, you know. And when Elliot Smith did it, the audience got behind. They were like all his friend, and they were like, you can do it, you know. And so he actually had this group of people who were really behind him, and that actually made him feel better and took away some of the other anxiety. So
You know, the thing I think about, like, in books and movies, is that we always love the hero who is the little guy, or the one who's struggling, or the one who's scared. We're always rooting for that guy. So why are we so afraid to be that guy in real life?
Yeah. Right? I took an amazing seminar at the Austin Film Festival, and I'm not going to be remember this woman's name, but she talked about what we love in heroes in films. Yeah. And she talked about Rocky. And she said, did Rocky win the fight? Right. And everyone in the audience was like, yeah. And she said, no, he didn't. He didn't win. He's one of our favorite movie heroes. You know, there's a freaking statue to him, right, in Philadelphia. And he didn't win. He strived. And that's what audiences love.
Yeah.
They can lose. But as long as we see that they really try and that they recognize what's important for Rocky, it was his relationship with Adrian, right? That's what we wanted to see work out.
Yeah.
And that's what we knew mattered as an audience, right? And that actually was intact in the end of that film. And that's what we were excited about.
Yeah.
And that he had done everything he possibly could. And that's what we admire in people.
Wow.
They don't need to win.
Yeah.
They just need to try.
Yeah.
And that's what we love.
Yeah. And that's the thing, too, about being anxious is, to me, is that when it's harder for you to do it, you're trying harder to do it. So that's a bigger thing. You're a bigger hero. I mean, you know, that's a
seriously,
thing, but you know.
No, that's the thing. It's like, it's much more impressive for somebody who's really bad at something to really keep trying.
Yep.
It's much more impressive than somebody who's already really good at it.
Right, exactly.
You know, so those are the people that we should be cheering on.
Yeah.
And those are the people that we do admire.
Yeah.
You know, you just keep going back. Like, I watched my boyfriend. He's going to hate that I'm telling this story. But he fixed up this car. He loves race cars. And he fixed up this old race car. And he does autocross, which is just like driving on this, there's cones, right? And so you have to go on this track. And it was the first time he'd driven this car. And he spun out so badly. Like, you do it, like, you're supposed to do it 3 times. And if you really spin out horribly, then they actually say that you can't do it again. But there was something sort of wrong with the car. But he spun out the first time really badly and went way off into the grass. And then he got in the car and he did it the second time. And he went way off into the grass to the point where it's like the announcer was sort of, when he got there, and the third time, the announcer was like, uh-oh, number 53 is up again. Everybody back up. But he did it.
Yeah.
I watched him do it a third time in front of all of those people after just blowing it just colossally the first 2 times. And I admired that so much.
Yeah.
You know, you got back into the car and you did it again and you finished and you didn't spin out the third time, you know?
Yeah.
And by the way, he's a good driver. He just hadn't like fixed this thing in the car that I have no idea what it was because I don't speak that language. But I admired the hell out of that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the MRI essay. You know, you go in, you have to do an MRI, and you go in and you have an instant panic and you're like, get me out of here.
Yes.
And you come out and then you have to go back in again.
It was like, awful.
And that was the thing I kept thinking, you know, doesn't it make it harder? Like, you know, the third time for your boyfriend, like, he must have been like, okay, there's, you know, I can't do this, you know.
I know.
The going back in, how did you go back in and make it okay?
Well, Xanax. So I did go out and I immediately chewed a Xanax. They had me chew a Xanax so it would go in faster.
Yeah.
So that did help. But I think I tell this story. I shouldn't tell this story because I'll never get another book deal. But I mean, I had a 4-month period of like just crippling self-doubt during my second draft. And the only thing that made me finish my second draft was that my fear of losing my book deal was worse than my fear of mediocrity, mm-hmm. than my mm-hmm. than my fear that my book was going to be terrible, right? Yeah. So I think that in some cases, it's just about the thing that you want being much stronger than your fear, figuring out a way. And in some cases, I think for people that you need to create some sort of external reason mm-hmm. if it's not inside you, right? If you don't desperately need this one thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I had an external deadline for the book, and that's what did it. And in this case, I do think, you know, it was also my brother was there. And he was, you know, he was sort of, if you go into an MRI machine, there's that hole kind of where your head goes in, and then mm-hmm. there's someone can see through it. And so he was talking to me through there, and he was making jokes. And I do think that in that case, it was really the drugs that helped that helped quite a bit. And then also, like, it was the I was still anxious, but honestly, the noises that an MRI machine makes, no one ever warned me. I don't know if you've ever been in an MRI machine, and this might have been a really old one,
yeah.
but it got comical. Honestly, I think right. some of it was that I thought it was so beyond just, this is surreal, the insane noises that this thing is making. It was this clanging and clanking, and it sounded like maybe an airline, like, engine going, and it sounded like somebody had some chains that they were just whacking against the side of it. And honestly, I would have, if I hadn't have needed to stay still, I would have been laughing.
Yeah.
Because I thought, this is ridiculous now. Yeah. It just sounds like there's a Foley artist back there with a group of people and like a saw and chains and a fan. And it just, and those, you know, those boots with the, you know, yeah, it was ridiculous. Yeah. I don't recommend an MRI to anybody.
Yeah. But finding it funny is a way to get through it.
Oh my gosh. And I think that everyone knows that, right? Who's ever struggled with anything mm-hmm. is that a sense of humor is what's going to take you through pretty much anything. I mean, who have, you know, I've had people in my classes who have written about cancer and in hilarious ways.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, but I've been at multiple funerals where I've laughed.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking about, you know, experiences that you've had with this person and you're chatting with friends and, you know, we laugh through that stuff.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think your in the chicken or egg kind of thing, what came first for you, anxiety or humor?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that my anxiety came first. I think that I didn't realize it, but I had anxiety for you know, from really, really early on. Or at the very least, I was always just kind of a nervous kid. But I actually remember the first time that I recognized sort of humor and the power of humor was that my mom, you know, we could kind of have whatever snacks we wanted, but my mom had Pepsis, and we just couldn't have her Pepsis. You know, it was like the one thing, you know, that moms have. It's just like, don't touch this. Don't touch my Pepsis. And my mom is this, you know, 5 foot, 95 pound tiny little adorable elven thing, and she just never got mad, and one of us kids, I don't remember, it was my brother was 2 years older than me, and one of us had I think most of one of her Pepsis that she'd put back in the fridge, and she was just so angry, and she was like, damn you kids, I can't have one thing in this house. You know, she sort of lost it, and which you just never saw. And my brother watched her totally straight faced. And I think he was like 11 and I was 9. And she sort of stopped her rant for a second. And there was this pause. And my brother said, stop it, Mom. You're scaring me. With a totally like, it was so dry, perfectly dry. And she lost it. She just started laughing. And I was just amazed.
Like Eureka.
Right. Look at what he did. He diffused it all with just this one comment.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to learn how to do, you know? And then it just sort of became, I think, in our house, this. My mother had this, still has, like this amazing, glorious cackle laugh. And I think it became a competition in our house, like who could get her to cackle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's lovely.
Yeah. But that's what I remember sort of the first time of like, oh, this is a tool that I'm going to use for the right. I mean, think of it like any argument you get in. If you can use humor to diffuse it, it may be one of the only things that can diffuse it.
Sometimes, yeah. It's really good for a marriage. You know?
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Wow,
that's really cool to hear because I kind of just assumed you came out of the womb with some dry comment, you know, some droll, you know, thing to say.
No, I mean, for my whole life, my brother was funnier than me, and my brother can tell a story a million times better than me. He's so good at it.
Is he anxious?
He periodically has anxiety, but for most of his life, he was just. My favorite thing about my brother is that he's never given a crap what anyone thought of him.
Yeah, wow.
And I dream of that.
Yeah, me too.
I dream of being that person.
Yeah.
I so admire that in him.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why he was always so funny.
Well, you say that, but you're hilarious.
Thanks.
You know?
Thanks.
I mean, humor can come from lots of places, obviously.
Sure.
And it comes really well from a self-deprecating place or a very, you know, like a eyes turned on the self kind of place.
So. For sure. Yeah. And I think there's I think anybody who's seen Nanette, the Hannah Gadsby Netflix special. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about this. I was talking about it with some friends, but she talks about self-deprecating humor, and she's a lesbian, and she talks about how if you're already in the margins and you're being self-deprecating, you might believe that you are being humble, but in actuality, it's humiliating because you're already in the margins. People already, and I think that's that thing. You know, it's the Dave Chappelle thing, right? Who created this show and created characters that he was creating what he believed was political satire and making creating all these characters that were African American tropes or whatever, and trying to make do commentary. And he realized that there were racist people who were watching the show who were like, oh yeah, this is what black people are like.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's an interesting shift that's happening, I think, because of the Hannah Gadsby thing about sort of self-deprecating humor and specifically about women and maybe people of color and anyone who's sort of in the margins a little bit more and whether or not that's something that we should continue to do or not.
Wow.
It's a whole conversation about it.
Wow.
And I am totally a self-deprecating person for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think the problem is humor is almost always at someone's expense, and I would rather it be at my expense than someone else's.
Right. Totally. Yeah.
So that's the kind of struggle that you have.
Yeah, but your humor, even when you're pointing it at yourself, it's pointing outward at the world. It's pointing outward to the way things are, you know, and that's the difference, I think. And it becomes, you know, about the whole story and not just about your story, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that ideally, any piece of satire or any piece of memoir or personal essay is speaking to, you're telling your own story, but ideally you're also telling some sort of universal truth about humanity. So those to me are the best pieces of literature or memoir is where I really, you know, like we've talked about before, like I can see myself in this and it really helps to illuminate something about my own life and hopefully allows me to change in some way, even if it's in the smallest, even if it just changes the way I think about something a little bit.
Right.
That's what I love.
Yeah. Small changes are big changes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's people, I think movies and books have tricked us into thinking that we will have, you know, we will just have these massive, huge shifts in the way that we think or the way that we do things out of nowhere. And it never happens.
It's not,
Life is just about these incremental, tiny changes. And it's really tedious and boring.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not an amazing story to tell. But over time, it is, you know?
Yeah. So now that the book is in the world, I'm wondering, you know, what the reception is, whether people are coming up to you and saying, hey, I'm anxious too, and sharing their stories and what kind of reaction you're getting.
It's been really lovely. I mean, I think that I started talking about the book, of course, years ago as I was working on it. And throughout the entire process, I was fascinated to learn, because normally if I'm having lunch with you and I haven't seen you in a couple years, or like I had lunch recently with a friend of mine from high school that I hadn't seen in 30 years, and I didn't really know him that well back then, and he said, well, what's your book about? And when someone asks me that, I have to say, well, I have anxiety. It's a pathology. I have clinical anxiety. And I wrote this book to try to, or no, I did all of these experiences to try to teach my brain that everything was going to be okay. So for the first time in my life, I'm having these conversations with people that I don't know very well, that I'm saying I have anxiety to.
Yeah.
And I think that that experience has been what's been extraordinary to me, is the number of people who then say, oh, me too.
Yeah.
And yes. and the number of people who have come to me and said, I think I have anxiety because I read your book and this stuff happens to me all the time. And this is how my brain works.
And they didn't know.
But wow. I mean, I say in my book, I wasn't diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder until I was probably 42.
Right.
So, and I knew that I had OCD. Mm-hmm. I had some, you know, some bouts with OCD over the course of my life, but I didn't know that either. And that's what was, you know, it changed my life when I was diagnosed with generalized anxiety, because I had thought my whole life that I'm just neurotic and that's just my nature, and I'm just a pessimist and that's just my nature. And I realized this isn't my nature. This is my pathology. So what is my nature? Am I a pessimist? Could I have ever been an optimist? Is that possible? And that's part of what I was trying to, the question that I was trying to answer with all of this ridiculous stuff that I did. And so, yeah, I think that's been wonderful, really, and a little bit scary, you know, to just sort of tell people all the time that you have this, what we as our culture still, I think, perceive as a weakness.
Right.
This is a weakness that I have. But it's, you know, I think that if I were to say to someone that I have lupus or I have, you know, they wouldn't say, oh, you're weak.
Right.
They would say, you have lupus. You have a thing. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think I would hope that, as I've said before, like the more we're honest about this stuff with one another, hopefully the more it just sort of becomes some people have this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that they're talking about it now with, you know, people who have autism and and that now they're talking about it as sort of neurodiversity, right? That it's not this thing. It's not a fault that you have. Right. You are different in this way, and it makes your brain actually work better in some ways. And these are the ways in which it, you know, it affects you as a person, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
Yeah. Although I wouldn't say that about anxiety. It's just, it's not great.
It's not,
I don't enjoy it.
don't you feel though that there is some, you know, the fact that you do feel this thing more that you've done, and that you, you know, I'm trying to make this be a good thing here.
The only thing that I will say is I am glad that my brain works in the way that it does, because my brain has served me well, regardless of its weaknesses. And I shouldn't call it a weakness, but I mean, regardless of its pathologies, that whatever whatever is going on with my brain, that it clearly has served me throughout my life. Mm-hmm. You know, and it has brought me a lot of joy and edification and illumination. And I think that it's also allowed me to feel more empathy for people that I have this thing. You know, I mean, I feel like if I didn't have anxiety, it's sort of the same thing that I feel a little bit about the fact that I got my heart broken. Mm. I think that people who haven't had their heart broken, I think that they maybe aren't as empathetic as people who have, you know. Yeah. I mean, certainly about heartbreak.
Yeah.
But I feel like when I got my heart broken for the first time, it felt like layers of my body had been sort of ripped off, mm-hmm. and that I was just walking around in the world with my organs showing,
yeah.
and that anyone could just walk over and poke at anything,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And I cried much more easily. And I still actually weirdly cry more easily than I did before I had my heart broken.
Huh.
And I just think that when we have these things that happen to us that are hard, that it helps us to recognize that everyone is struggling in some way,
yeah.
you know? So I can't say that I'm grateful that I have this,
right.
but I also, I can't imagine my life any different,
right?
You know? And I mean, you know, all the stuff that I've been through, this book has been an unbelievable gift. And
yeah.
the writing of it was so illuminating for me and was so healing for me. And, you know, I talk about in this class that I teach, I talk about Maria Bamford, who's a comedian who has OCD, intrusive thought, kind of the similar OCD mm-hmm. that I was diagnosed with. And I talk about how about the science of comedy and telling jokes, and how when you're in front of a live audience and you make them laugh, it releases endorphins in their body.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear them laughing, it releases endorphins in your body.
Yeah.
And Maria Bamford, when she does comedy, she actually tells jokes about her OCD, which is a devastating disease, very difficult to live with. So she's literally taken her pain and turned it into joy.
Yeah.
Right? Like
yeah.
she's caused her, you know, these stories about her pain have caused both her and the audience to share these endorphins.
Yeah.
And I think that is actually magical.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like there was struggle and there was difficulty in my story, but it has brought me so much pleasure and joy and connection to people to actually have the book and be able to talk about it with people.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful,
that's
which
good.
Is weird for me. I am almost never grateful. Yeah, it's the pessimist in me.
Well, how can we find out more about your book?
So people can go to my website, which is just CourtneyHaumeister.com, it's really hard to spell. So you can maybe Google Courtney Haumeister and you can go to it. I think that we also have it listed under OkayFineWhatever'sville.com. So that's another way to get to it. But it's, yeah, maybe just you could also Google Okay, Fine, Whatever, and hopefully it will come up.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's great. There's a wonderful like short film that was written, it's adapted from the book, and it was produced and directed by my friend Marie Murphy, and the art is by Karen Whippick, who is this unbelievable, amazing Portland artist, and it was animated and edited by Nick Wichman, who did an extraordinary job on a shoestring budget. So I'm very proud of that, and they can see that at the website.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. I really love talking to you today.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Courtney Haumeister, Portland-based author of the new book, Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things, in conversation with Gigi Little, editor of City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Courtney and Gigi for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.
Heat change, high anxiety. It's always the same. Hey, anxiety. It's you that I blame. It's very clear to me. I've got to give in. High anxiety. And remember, folks, be good to your parents. They've been good to you. You win.